Democratic Senator Eddie Melton explores a run for governor. President Trump proposes new tariffs on Mexico. That plus Elizabeth Warren campaigns in Indiana and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending June 7th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, State Senator Eddie Melton became the first Indiana Democrat to take formal steps towards a gubernatorial run in 2020. Melton announced the formation of an exploratory committee in Gary, his hometown. As a first-term senator and deputy chair of the Indiana Democratic Party, he says he's traveled his district and the state listening to the issues that Hoosier voters are concerned about. Chief among them, Melton says, education. Melton is the highest-ranking Democrat on the Senate Education Committee and a former member of the State Board of Education. He would also be the first person of color ever nominated to run for governor by a major party in Indiana. That's something he says he views as an opportunity, not a challenge. Melton says he hasn't set a timetable to officially decide on a gubernatorial run. Could Eddie Melton pose a serious challenge to Governor Holcomb? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Phil Johnson, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Jennifer Hollowell, is Melton an attractive candidate for the Democrats?
Well, I do think that he's... I think he's well-liked. He has a good reputation at the State House. I think he's worked across the aisle and worked respectfully with the governor. He's actually been very complimentary of the governor on a variety of issues. I think the bigger challenge really is for all Democrats that they would be running against Governor Holcomb. He's incredibly popular. He's done a tremendous job. He's very savvy. And if you look at his record, you know, we have low unemployment, we have record investment, we have record job numbers, we have record investment in education, all kinds of things, and Hoosiers are very happy about the direction that the state is going under Governor Holcomb's leadership. So I think that's a challenge for whoever Democrats may put up.
Indiana's an increasingly red state, and this is a governor who, at the very minimum, I don't think this is partisan to say, I don't think he's pissed anybody off. So quite frankly, Eddie Melton or anyone, are Democrats going to be able to really mount a challenge to Eric Holcomb?
Yeah, absolutely they will. I think even talking about accomplishments, we have to remember that almost a third of Hoosiers don't even know who Eric Holcomb is. So we'll hear talk of his war chest and the money that he's raised. Well, he's going to need that because he's got to get his name ID out there. For 3 years, the governor's been governor for 3 years, and for nearly a third of folks to not even know who he is, that's a problem for him. Actually, the same polling had his favorability below 50 as well. So Senator Melton's an attractive candidate, absolutely. So are the two other Democrats that have been taking some active steps towards running, Representative Carly Macer here in Indianapolis, Dr. Woody Myers as well. So absolutely, this is going to be an interesting race.
But I would say, if that's what you're basing on, their name ID is like zero.
Yeah.
They're also not the sitting
governor
of the state.
They have zero money and zero name ID.
Well, they're also not the sitting governor of the state who's been here for 3 years. So
Eddie Melton talked about he would be the first, if he's eventually the Democratic nominee, he would be for the first person of color to run for governor in Indiana from a major party ticket. He said he views that as not as a challenge, but as an opportunity. Of course, what else is he going to say? Is it an opportunity or a challenge?
I don't really think it's either. Maybe I'm being too naive or pie in the sky, but I don't think people are looking at race as much anymore. I think they're looking at his philosophy and what he's bringing. He focused a lot on education issues in the legislature and in his career. And also, you know, when I chatted with him this week, he is trying to point to one key weak point that Governor Holcomb has, which is some problems they've had in the Veterans Affairs Agency, which, to Holcomb's credit, he has, you know, been trying to clean up, but they were pretty serious issues. So he's trying to focus on that.
This is perhaps a gubernatorial race that will have a greater focus than ever before on education because we won't have a state superintendent's race anymore, and that person will be appointed by the governor, whether it's Eric Holcomb or someone else. So, in light of that, does that make Eddie Melton, who has education credentials,
a particularly attractive candidate for the Democrats.
Sure, I agree with what has been said here. He is an attractive candidate. And you're right, because of his service on the State Board of Education and his relationship with education as an issue during his service in the State House on the Education Committee in the Senate, clearly that, I think, would help. He is an attractive candidate. He has one big obstacle, though. Indiana does not fire independently elected governors. Only one incumbent, keep in mind, has ever been turned out of office. Now, we should offer the asterisk.
With a big old caveat
we didn't used to have two-term governors.
Right, right.
But since we've had two-term governors, the only person incumbent who has been turned out of office was Joe Kernan, who was not independently elected. He had ascended to the role, of course, after the death of the governor. But Indiana tends not to, even in times of supposed voter dissatisfaction, it doesn't seem to have a tradition of taking it out on the CEO of the state of Indiana.
Yeah, I mean, in 2008, when Barack Obama won the state of Indiana, the first Democrat to do so since, I think, LBJ, Mitch Daniels ran away with the race.
And having said that, though, I think we also can't discount the factors that extend from beyond the borders of the state of Indiana in terms not just of deciding do I like this candidate or not, but deciding do I sit this out this election, do I work extra hard for my party, or do I take a break?
So we may be talking a little bit about
something
like that later
will.
On the show. Yeah. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, would Democratic Senator Eddie Melton have a chance to beat Governor Eric Holcomb? A yes, B no, or C, it's June of 2019, it's too soon to tell. Last week's question, will the Supreme Court overturn Roe v. Wade within the next 5 years? Only 26% of you say yes, 74% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana's Republican U.S. senators are balking at President Trump's new proposed tariffs on Mexican imports.
The new tariffs would impose a 5% levy on Mexican goods beginning next week. President Trump's announcement of those tariffs via tweet referenced immigration concerns at the U.S.'s southern border. Trump threatened to increase the tariffs to 25% by October if Mexico doesn't respond. Republican Senator Todd Young says he has serious concerns about the president's move and its impact on the Hoosier economy. Fellow Indiana Senator Mike Braun and Young both acknowledged what they view as a crisis at the border, but Braun, also a Republican, says he's worried the tariffs could negatively impact the president's proposed U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal that would replace NAFTA.
Phil Johnson, we've long heard from Republicans that they don't like some of the president's tariffs and its impacts, more its impacts on the economy, particularly in Indiana, but they haven't really done anything about it. Is this the bridge too far?
Yeah, we've seen some brave press releases and anonymous comments in the past, no action with Republicans getting away from Donald Trump. So I'll believe it when I see it. What I do know is these tariffs are having a real impact here in Indiana. We saw noted liberal think tank, the Indiana State Chamber of Commerce, saying that it was going to cost, a threat to our economy. I saw something, I believe, from the Farm Bureau saying that it cost soybeans. The soybean market had gone down by $1 billion here in the state. We may never regain that market again. So these are serious. This is having a real impact. So I'm hopeful that they take some steps.
Was this the bridge too far?
Look, I mean, Republicans have spoken out and business leaders have spoken out over the last couple of years on some of these different issues. I think what's most important to look at in this instance is this is the way the president negotiates. This is the way he gets people to the table. And it's been effective up until this point, and I think we're seeing it effective right now. So almost immediately after he made that announcement, Mexico was sending high-level officials to D.C. to start negotiating with the Trump administration, and already in a couple of days, a couple of hours, we're seeing some movement in things that they're willing to do to try to address the issues, and that's what brings them to the table. So I think that over the next few days and months, we'll see how this all plays out, but it's not surprising. And also to this point, I think Republicans are still trusting that this process is going to work. And there are a lot of voters, I've listened to voters who have challenges, who have businesses that are impacted, and they're still sticking with the president because overall they'd like to see the long term of it play out, even if in the short term it's a challenge.
And that's exactly what I want to ask you. So far we've seen press releases or words from Republicans, but no actions to stop or curtail these economic decisions that the president has been making. But this time we're hearing a lot more out of D.C. about if the tariffs go into effect, we have to do something to stop them. Do you think that Republicans will risk the voters' wrath if that's what they do?
Well, keep in mind, you made a very important point when you asked the question. They're saying if the tariffs go into effect, we've got to draw the line. So you, to a certain extent, you can kind of have your cake and eat it too right now. You can say, I'm standing with farmers. I am standing with those who could be hurt by this. But will it, what would really happen when push comes to shove? Would it be more of the anonymous, you know, some people are dissatisfied, there are people rumbling within the caucus, or would they actually do something? Because we've seen very little willingness, as Phil suggested, to do something. So this really has to play out a little bit more. Jennifer, right. If in fact this game of, you know, bluffing or whatever, this poker game that the president's engaged in delivers results, I guess no harm, no foul. He wins the battle. If not, and the subsidies, either those endorsed by our legislative branch in Congress or those that were unilaterally basically bestowed through presidential power and fiat to farmers in terms of to mitigate some of the effects here of some of the tariffs. I mean, he can't sustain this policy long term. Farmers, I think, have to reach a point where they rebel. So either it gets the results that Jennifer's talking about, or Republicans will have to come off the bench and actually do something.
Let's, for the second, assume that the tariffs do go into effect, these new tariffs on Mexico, and Republicans do take action in Congress to stop them. Clearly, there's an appetite from the Democrats to do that, but let's say Republicans join them, or at least enough of them. Do you think voters will hold Republicans accountable for that? Are they more loyal to the president than their own member of Congress?
I think on this particular issue, I think it would be fine for the I don't think that the lawmakers who would vote against these Mexico tariffs would be bothered, because it's way different than the trade war issue, which is very complicated and definitely has long term. This was literally a Twitter fiat with no metrics, no idea of what they would have to do in order to not get the tariffs. And I think it just came out of nowhere. And it's kind of so incredible that I think even the voters would be like, maybe not.
On this one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren made campaign stops in Indiana this week, including near fellow candidate and South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg's backyard. Warren made campaign stops in Elkhart at the RV Hall of Fame and Fort Wayne. The latter was an MSNBC town hall. Warren pitched her central message. She has a plan, she says, for everything. In Elkhart, she talked about eliminating lobbying, fighting what she calls gerrymandering, and imposing a wealth tax on those making more than $50 million a year as a way to pay for student loan debt, college education, and child care. At her MSNBC town hall, host Chris Hayes asked why Fort Wayne, which the Warren camp requested. Warren says it's because the people of Fort Wayne know how to build an economy.
But people in Fort Wayne, Indiana, also understand that leaving it to a handful of giant multinational corporations to build our economy just isn't working. You know, those big corporations, they don't have any loyalty to America. They don't have any loyalty to American workers. They have loyalty to exactly one thing, and that is their own profits.
John Schwanis, does this message work in Indiana?
You know, it's a legitimate question, but I'm not sure it's the right time to ask that question. The bigger question right now is, does it appeal to to active Democratic voters in this state? Because seen time and time again, because of the polarization of our political beliefs system and the people who participate in caucuses and primaries, it doesn't matter what kind of pitch you make to the electorate as a whole at this point in the process. Because
yeah,
we all know
you've got
to get to the general election, and that means if you're a Democrat, you have to tack to the left toward the so-called more progressive wing of the party, and certainly if you're Republican, you're wanting to tack right. And then one would hope, at least conventional wisdom dictated, that you'd go back to the center. Now, it doesn't always happen, as we saw with the current occupant of the White House, but at least that's the way things used to work, and maybe we'll get back to that. So at this point, I think while that's a well-intended question, I'd say, does it appeal to active Democratic caucus or primary voters. And to that, in that context, I'd say yes.
This seemed not, it was a friendly crowd at the town hall, just like the Pete Buttigieg one on Fox News was a friendly crowd. But Fort Wayne's not exactly the most liberal part of Indiana.
It isn't. I mean, we do have a Democrat mayor. We've had a Democrat mayor for years and years. So, you know, when you're looking at Indiana as a whole, that is one area that her message would come across well. And I think, personally, I think it was all about trying to tie into Buttigieg's and kind of curb his momentum a little here. Mm-hmm. I think Indiana was, and the northern region was chosen specifically for that reason by them.
Yeah, is that more about looking at another candidate running for president than it was about being in Indiana?
I think down the road, I think Carrier or UTEC, there are 800 jobs were lost right down the road from there as well. So, I mean, that could be a reason for why they chose that location, too. I don't think I'd read too much into that location. I saw some interesting numbers. 12% of Americans thought that the Trump tax cuts benefited them, while 58% thought they benefited wealthy Americans. So obviously there are numbers to back up that, and that was polling across, not just political polling for one party or the other. That was polling for everyone. So I think that message does resonate with a wide swath of Americans, not just one party or the other.
John made the point about appealing to primary voters versus general election voters, but general election voters in some cases will remember what you said when you were running in the primary. So
certainly.
Is that
You're
message...
You're so old school.
Maybe I am a little old school, but that message in Indiana in general, does that play very well?
Not at all. I mean, not at all. What a waste of time. I just think this is a really dumb move. So no, that message doesn't resonate with Hoosiers in any way, shape, or form. And the backdrop of Fort Wayne on the heels of an announcement by General Motors bringing hundreds of new jobs to Fort Wayne, one of those big corporations, no, she's so out of step with Hoosiers, and I think it was a waste of time for a primary or a general election campaign, and I'd love for her to be the nominee. Love for that to happen.
All right, well, Republican precinct committee people chose Indiana's new state representative this week, as Darlene Sherman will replace Representative David Frizzell, who recently stepped down.
Sherman has spent much of her career in government. She served on the staffs of Governors Bob Orr and Mitch Daniels and worked for Congresswoman Susan Brooks. Sherman says that experience will give her a boost as she steps into elected office for the first time. Sherman replaces David Frizzell, who retired after more than 25 years in the legislature. She'll serve out the rest of his term, which runs until November 2020.
Nikki Kelly, with Sherman joining the General Assembly, 30 out of 150 lawmakers, which is 20%, if I'm doing the math correctly, and somebody should check me because I'm a journalist doing math, but they first entered the legislature via a private caucus. Is that a problem?
I think it's been a problem for a bit, and it continues to be. I mean, essentially, she was elected to that post with like a couple dozen votes.
It was 22 people out of 34.
Which I think is pretty amazing. Now, having said that, while I do think it's a problem, I don't know what the answer is. I don't think it's special elections. I think that's too expensive and problematic. But I do know that there are lawmakers who run for election knowing they're going to leave within a year or so. And you know, maybe there has to be some sort of consequence. Maybe we don't fill those posts, you know? And so they have to think longer about, am I going to run for election and am I going to fulfill that seat?
Is it a problem?
Well, the number statistic, assuming it's correct, that is a startling figure. But the more startling figure, it seems to me, and the more troubling figure isn't that one. It's how many members of the House and Senate face no opposition in actual elections.
Sure.
And that's a different issue in terms of non-competitive districts. If you want to look at regardless of how they got into their seats, whether it was through a precinct committee vote or was actually at the ballot box with the general electorate, a lot of those people never faced opposition again after that when it came November of a given. So that's a problem. Darlene, I've known for a long time since she was Bob Orr's press secretary and I covered state government. I think she must have been in kindergarten at the time. She's very certainly talented, and I think will do a fine job. Wish her the best.
Yeah, I want to clarify. This conversation is not to call into question Darlene Sherman's or anyone's credentials as a lawmaker, but to some of the point he just made, I mean, the power of incumbency isn't unique to Indiana, certainly, but in a state like Indiana, where we see a lot of people on both sides of the aisle never really get challenged, maybe in the primary sometimes, and even then, again, the power of incumbency being what it is, 22 people basically decided who the next state representative will be, probably not just for the next year, but maybe much longer to come. Is that system good?
Well, certainly it's a system that we designed, and we could change it if we wanted, and we haven't. But those 22 people also are some of the most invested, attentive people to this process. These are precinct committeemen who are elected by voters or appointed if it was an open spot. But these are people who are savvy and pay a lot of attention, so they are, they are qualified to make those decisions. I'll say, as I've watched a lot of these caucuses, and sometimes I'll say to myself, he or she would not have gotten through a primary election. This is a case where Darlene Sherman would have won a full-out primary if there were a full-out primary. She's fantastic, and she's probably one of the most qualified, prepared people to go in and be a state representative because she's worked in government at the state, local, federal level. She knows how it works. And she's very, very bright and talented, and I look forward to working with her.
And she did cite that, too, as being she's going to hit the ground running more than maybe anybody else could have. To Nikki's point, which was, if this isn't the right system, what is the right system? Is this just the best of what we can do?
Actually, I don't think this system is... What are the alternatives? I know Nikki mentioned that. There could be a special election that's expensive. You don't want to put that on the taxpayers. This is partly a function of a citizen legislature where jobs may change. I think ultimately if we could, and I'm agreeing with John here, if we could have...
Wait, I have an affidavit.
I checked my watch. We'll sign it
after the show.
If we had competitive elections in all of these districts, if we had independent redistricting and there wasn't gerrymandering, ultimately all of these people would face competitive elections in the future, be it 2 years, be it 4 years, 4 years being the longest, but at least they would face the voters in a competitive election afterwards. Yes, I understand why this appears to be an issue, but the bigger issue here is competitive elections.
And that would negate the concern. If what you're saying, the good scenario where you had competitive general elections, then the other ceases to be an issue, it seems.
Right.
Well, President Trump's approval rating is underwater in most of the key battleground states in next year's election, though he's still just ahead in the Hoosier state.
49% of Hoosiers in the latest tracking poll from the Morning Consult approve of President Trump, compared to 46% who disapprove. That net approval of about 3% is largely on par with where the president's numbers have been in Indiana for well over a year, hovering around 3-6%. But it marks a significant downgrade from the beginning of his presidency, when his net approval was 22% after winning Indiana by 19 points.
Phil Johnson, will these numbers, if they stay where they are roughly, which is he's better and more liked than disliked, but not by as much, will that matter by the time we get to Election Day 2020?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it will. I think we will have a competitive election here in Indiana. I think it's worth pointing out that the president in Indiana won by 19 points in 2016. The governor's race was decided by 6 points. That margin is, you're the one who does the math around here.
It's closer. It's
significantly closer, so it should make for a very interesting governor's race. Yes, that definitely matters.
I am not suggesting that President Trump's going to lose Indiana. I personally don't think he will. But it's not a question of will he win or lose. It's how much will he win by. And if he's only winning by a few percentage points, will that matter down ballot?
Well, let's not forget that the polling, as it relates to President Trump, has been off since before he was elected, right?
That's true.
All the polls showed he was going to lose. Did polls in Indiana show him up by 19 points? I don't believe so. And so what we've learned is there are a lot of Trump supporters who are not going to tell pollsters who they support because they don't want to be targeted by the left. So those numbers I don't think mean much. But what I will say is, I don't know a single person who voted for President Trump who no longer supports him. He has not lost support among the voters that elected him. And if you look at his numbers nationwide, I mean, I think he was at an all-time high last week.
He certainly solidified his base.
And it's been steady in Indiana. These numbers have been steady since shortly after he took office. They've fluctuated 2 or 3 points.
There was a drop, but then they've stayed relatively consistent. All right. Well, finally, the World Cup kicks off today, and I'm very excited about that, even if maybe some of my panelists aren't. And that's with host nation France facing South Korea. The U.S. begins its title defense Tuesday against Thailand. Jennifer Hollowell, will the U.S. women retain their crown?
Oh, absolutely.
That's a great
answer. Absolutely.
Definitely.
Nikki Kelly?
I have no idea.
A great answer, too. John?
Let's go yes. Why not?
All right. I'm going to bet against the U.S. women. I think England is my dark horse. I think they're going to win it. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Phil Johnson, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/iwir, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.